see if I can get this where I can see it. Block my view. Okay. Do you like watching those period piece movies that purport to be historically accurate? You know, the ones that begin with the disclaimer, based on a true story or inspired by actual events? A disclaimer that usually seems to mean that the costume and makeup artists have worked meticulously to make things seem, look precisely like they did in the era they're trying to portray, while the screenwriter got to take liberties with the script to make the historical narrative fit his story and not the other way around. We don't usually complain, though, as long as the story is told well, as long as it tugs at our hearts in just the right way. We can excuse some inconvenient inaccuracies. A movie is only 2 hours long, 3 hours tops, so something has to be sacrificed in the service of compelling storytelling. Sometimes that something is the truth. Not that they've set out or hope to end up with a lie. It's almost always much more subtle than that. Take, for example, your average movie set in the southern United States, which seeks to portray the societal and institutional racism towards African Americans that existed there, especially 50, 60, and more years ago. Or even films that depict the raw anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Usually we feel a visceral sense of disgust that humans could ever behave in this way. We can't imagine that had we been there among the crowd, that we would have just followed along like sheep, that we wouldn't have spoken up at the injustice, that we wouldn't have at least thought differently. But that's exactly what's wrong with so many of these movies, or much historical literature for that matter, and the way we remember and retell things. If a film claims to address an issue like the rise of a poisonous, hateful ideology, but leaves us unable to understand how it is that an individual, a family, a village, or a society came to drink that poison like it was orange juice, how if we had been one of them, we too might not have acted differently, then that film has failed. Again, it's not that films like this set out to fail. They may not be lying outright about how a society slowly hardens in ways that are complex and often unforeseen, but neither are they necessarily interested in telling that nuanced truth. Most storytellers like their villains to be just that, villains. Evil through and through, unperturbed by a conscience, and their heroes are likewise unsullied by compromise or some other unpardonable character flaw. But films so rarely have the bandwidth, so rarely have or take the time that's necessary to depict that sometimes long and messy, but entirely plausible, descent into deception and ultimately destruction. The thing is, it takes resolving to look at that people or society with sustained sympathy, a constant sympathy, in order to understand how the decisions they made were plausible. Not to explain away, justify, minimize, or excuse, but to understand how a rational person, how even a person like yourself, in their shoes, could plausibly behave in such a way and make a series of decisions that brought them to such a place. It's so much easier to say, well, the Germans collectively lost their minds under the Nazis, or the Germans as a whole are simply evil, or at least they were in 1930, with the exception of those who resisted. But even though there is a kind of consensus about World War II and almost anything negative said about the enemy is accepted, I think these types of comments can be lazy, dangerous even. Lazy because I think it shows a lack of a serious attempt to understand the root causes, and dangerous because something similar could show up again closer to home and we wouldn't recognize it precisely because we didn't understand it. This is the type of language we use about the enemy in the Middle East all the time. And by we, I mean us, followers of Jesus of various sect and denomination. So let's start with ISIS. Surely there's no controversy over the obvious evil that is ISIS, known as Islamic State. ISIS has slaughtered and beheaded Christians. They have enforced draconian medieval laws where they rule and threaten to enslave whole populations should they succeed in advancing. There's no need to recount their atrocities here. We've all read and even seen the videos of their horrific crimes. But ISIS is an example of how a very sensational crudeness, a very raw and plain evil, can be a distraction from a more nuanced but ultimately more sinister danger. What do I mean? Seeing images recently of the Iraqi military, Kurdish Peshmerga, and more disconcertingly, Shia militia forces advancing on Mosul to recover Iraq's second largest city from ISIS, I was reminded of a photo someone posted on Twitter last March when a similar array of forces retook Tikrit from ISIS. The picture shows an ISIS flag painted on a concrete barrier that has been defaced, and mounted atop is the flag of one of the myriad Shia militias, Saray al-Khorasani, and the comment accompanying the image was a snarky remark that said, here I have the picture, and I don't know if it was put up, but and I don't know if you can see this, but there's the picture. That's the ISIS flag, and that's the flag of the Shiite militia right there. And the, could you guys see that a little bit maybe? No?
That's very thoughtful of you, though.
I only sent it like 2 seconds ago, but there's an ISIS flag. On top of that flag is a Shiite militia flag, okay? Anyway, this snide remark that was in the Twitter remark said, Tikrit, liberated from anti-West Islamist extremists by anti-West Islamist extremists. The point is clear. There has long been a concern in Iraq that many of the Shia militias, as proxies of the clerical regime in Iran, would carry out revenge attacks upon the Sunni populations where ISIS has been ensconced now for several years. It is this fear that in some cases has led led Sunnis to fear the Shia militias more than they fear ISIS. Sunnis in Iraq and across the Arab world have watched as Shia militia have poured into Syria to back the government's brutal repression of the Sunni rebellion there, slaughtering nearly 500,000 of their co-religionists. That is to say, multiple times more than ISIS has come close to murdering. In other words, many in the Sunni Arab world may consider ISIS a threat, but they are far more concerned with the genocidal campaign now being waged against Sunnis in Syria. This is now complicated further. In Iraq, we've seen how Christian villages have been liberated by the Iraqi army, crosses being erected and bells ringing in churches that have lied dormant under ISIS. Christians in Iraq have either fallen upon the Shia-dominated state or upon renegade Kurdish fallen upon the renegade Kurdish separatist enclave in the north for protection. And mercifully, neither Sunni or Shia in Iraq seem to associate them, the Christians, with the crimes and excesses of war that have been committed back and forth against each other over the years. This is pointedly not the case in Syria. A family belonging to the minority Alawite sect has ruled Syria, and they were shrewd in co-opting other minorities in their corrupt governance so that they would be implicated and therefore obligated to remain loyal. and it worked. Today, Christians are integrated well into the government and military ranks and closely associated with the regime's cruel suppression of Sunnis. The Christians, may fear ISIS, but they made a pact with the devil to fight them, it is said of those Christians in Syria. Interestingly, I've found this isn't much of a moral quandary for some Christians, Western Christians. I've heard many people say that it isn't too much of a problem as long as Christians in Syria can guarantee their survival. They're between a rock and a hard place, so they can't be held accountable for having to fight on behalf of a brutal regime. The alternatives are worse, they say. But then this week introduced a further complication. In Lebanon, the parliament finally elected a president after 2.5 years in which they operated without a head of state. As you may know, Lebanon is divided into many minority sects, and their consensual system of government reserves a position of president for Maronite Christians. But the parties had been unable to come to an agreement on a candidate, largely because of increasing strife between Sunnis and Shia that spilled over from Syria into Lebanon. Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia militia, has played a pivotal role in the war there, but has also, with guidance from Iran, asserted nearly full dominance of the political life of the country at home in Lebanon. These Christians in Syria, having long lost the political authority they once knew, nevertheless remained divided for some years over whether to throw their lot in with the Sunni political leadership or with Hezbollah. It is now clear that a majority of at least their political leadership considers it prudent to tie their fate with Hezbollah. But now those same people I just mentioned, who had no dilemma before, suddenly find this situation inconceivable and unacceptable. It's as if they had no qualms about Christians, if it meant their survival, having to fight alongside Hezbollah in Syria and firing missiles at innocent civilians in Aleppo. But now that these Lebanese Christians are standing alongside Hezbollah as they aim their missiles at Haifa, that equation has changed and it's no longer tolerable. The point is, that I'm trying to make with all of this, is that as you add complexity to the picture, and the closer you bring it to home, it becomes easier to identify and empathize with the characters on both sides, regardless of who you determine to be more in the right or more in the wrong. And now, forgive me, but I'm going to say that this is what personal relationships are like. I promise I ran this by Eva, and although at first she thought I might be saying that I was a U.S. aircraft carrier and she was ISIS in this metaphor, I'm not saying that exactly. No, nothing like that. But the thing is, when there's conflict, and no relationship is without conflict at some level, I think we often want to simplify the retelling of the sequence of events that led to conflict so that we can narrow it down to the core issues that caused it. Rather, I should say that's what I like to do. This whole argument stems from the fact that you think I haven't been open with you about such and such, is something I would say. As if our disputes could so neatly be distilled down to a single element, isolated and then zapped and solved, like swatting a pesky mosquito. Everything I demanded when it comes to reading politics, I somehow throw out the window in a heated spat with my wife. In politics, I'm constantly insisting that people not allow their natural biases, where they're from and what they believe, prejudice what they think they know about the other side thinks or what motivates them. And I make a real effort to do the same when I try to imagine why a young Lebanese Shi might have joined Hezbollah to fight an extremely costly war in Syria. But then I'll refuse to accept the logic of my brother's point of view in an argument, and I'll lash out at him. And here I'm probably Hezbollah, not the aircraft carrier. But I'll also still expect that he receive my argument simply because it made sense to me, without a thought for how he would see it. Somehow I hypocritically violate the rules and forget that I can't judge him without hearing him first. That it's not fair to let past hurts discolor the discussion now. And that as much as I hate to admit it, I could be misreading his intentions, his words. That I could be wrong. So, in defense of using strange metaphors to make a point, I turn to the Bible. Every child knows the story of Jonah. We know how he was called to deliver a prophetic word of destruction upon the ISIS of his day, or the Ba'athist Syrian regime of his day, or the Nazis or Stalinist regime of his day. Take your pick. Skipping past the whole storm and whale episode, we know what happens when he prophesies over the city. The prophecy works by not coming true. Now, this is an important note to people who are often enthralled with the apocalyptic and end times. The biblical prophets were not in competition with fortune tellers and wizards who could divine the future with a crystal ball. The purpose of prophecy was not primarily intended for someone in 2016 to be able to identify Gog and Magog with Russia and China and try to assess exactly how and when they might attack Israel. The prophet's main goal was to call people to repentance. Their hope, expressing the heart of God, was that the coming damnation would not occur, that the onslaught of the enemy could be averted, if only his people would turn back to him. This is what troubled Jonah so much. Here it is in Jonah 3. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. Then he cried out and said, "Yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. So the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. Then the word of the king of Nineveh came to the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne and laid aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. And he caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, 'Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water. But let man and beast be covered with sackcloth. Cry mightily to God. Yes, let everyone turn from his evil way and from violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his first fierce anger so that we will not perish?' Then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way. And God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it." This is where we often stop reading, especially to the kids, because chapter 4 seems so anticlimactic and kind of pathetic. But this is really the crux of the lesson for me. "But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord and said, 'Ah, Lord, was this not what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live.'" Maybe it was like this for you, but growing up reading this, I always thought that this was a stupid comment. Why is he blaming God for being a loving God? That just sounds silly. He's blaming him for acting in character. But again, it's because we're so removed from these characters and their context. If Jonah's town had been overrun by ISIS and he was asked to preach and receive their repentance, then a reaction like this makes perfect sense. Then the Lord said, "Is it right for you to be angry?" So Jonah went out to the city and sat on the east side of the city. There he made himself a shelter and sat under it in the shade till he might see what would become of the city. It's as if he's still hoping it might be destroyed after all. And the Lord God prepared a plant and made it come over Jonah, that it might be shade for his head to deliver him from his misery. So Jonah was grateful for the plant, but as morning dawned, and the next day God prepared a worm, and it so damaged the plant that it withered. And it happened when the sun arose that God prepared a vehement east wind, and the sun beat on Jonah's head that he grew faint, and he wished death for himself, and said, "It is better for me to die than live." Then God said to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" And he said, "It is right for me to be angry, even to death." But the Lord said, "You have had pity on the plant for which you have not labored nor made it grow, and which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, in which are more than 120,000 persons who cannot discern between their right hand and their left, and much livestock? If you can have pity on a plant," God says, "then you can have pity on a human being." So there's the funny metaphor. This Isis of Nineveh, by the way, is modern day Mosul, has indeed become wicked, but they're redeemable. They've been in a corrupted culture that they cannot discern between their right hand and their left. That's it. That's the last thing God says. And that's how the book of Jonah ends. It's an appeal to empathize with the slaughterers of Nineveh. An appeal to Jonah, to us the readers, to attempt to understand a murderer's moral predicament, to understand their psychology. God didn't say that they were smitten by the worship of their god Marduk, or whoever their pagan deity was at the time. Not that ideology and religion wouldn't have played a part, but he was asking Jonah to remember that there were rational people under those twisted systems. Those contexts people are in are always complex, but we should not give up trying to understand or settle for simplistic explanations. Most of all, whether with our worst enemies or with our closest friends, I see it's clear I have no excuse to give up trying to engage with empathy and hope for restoration.